Hello and welcome to Transmission. Today, Q is joined by Martin Darana, Head of Flexibility and Structured Origination in Germany for ENGIE, the French multinational electric utility company. In this episode, they discuss the booming German battery market with 500 gigawatts in connection queues, how batteries generate revenue through wholesale markets and ancillary services without subsidies, and the emergence of fixed-price flexibility purchase agreements as a new risk management tool. As always, if you're enjoying Transmission, feel free to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's jump in.
Hello, Martin.
Hi, Katin.
Lovely to see you twice in 24 hours.
Yeah, a pleasure.
Pretty dehydrated after baking in the sun at the Oval yesterday. We should probably do a shout to Fritz for inviting us along to the T20.
We had a good night.
How was it? What was your experience of British cricket then?
Not understanding everything, to be honest, but still a good time, yeah.
It was a good game.
Good people, yeah.
It was a good game. All right, Martin, we're going to talk about the German market in great detail. I actually think we could do, knowing you, we could do this podcast as just contrarian views. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Maybe we'll give you a bit more space at the end to do more than one. But for our listeners, who are you, Martin? What do you do at ENGIE? And let's go from there.
Perfect. So my name is Martin. I work at ENGIE since 2 years. I'm responsible for flexibility and structured origination in Germany for the trading part of ENGIE. ENGIE as a company, I mean, I guess everybody knows, but we are basically a vertically integrated utility. We are investing into assets, into grids. We have, of course, a lot of customers that we supply. And ENGIE trading is effectively at the core of that, optimizing all the assets of the group, supplying all the customers, and then providing risk management tools to clients that have, for instance, batteries. That's what I do all day long.
And in another life, we could have ended up working on the same floor. My previous gig at Kiwi Power got bought by, I think you're part of ENGIE, right? ENGIE Gem or Gems?
Gems, so yeah, which is now called SEM. It's a new name, but it still is trading, origination, asset optimization, and supply of clients.
So what's the S? Because it used
supply
to be
and
global
energy management.
Okay, all right. Okay.
It's now international supply and energy management, yes.
Excellent, excellent. So we're going to talk about the German battery market. There's tons of interest in this space. We've got assets being built. Investors are finally getting comfortable with this market. Could you give us a lay of the land of the battery world in Germany before we go down the rabbit holes?
Sure, absolutely. So first thing to say is that the German market is really hot at the moment. I mean, you have numbers of connection queues that are adding up to 500 gigawatts. It was mentioned in a few podcasts here already. It's a hot market because the needs are huge. I mean, Germany in 2030 will have something like 300 gigawatts of renewables. Targets at least for consumption at peak of 70 to 80 gigs. So the need for flexibility to match demand and production is just huge. That is calling up for short-term flexibility. That's where batteries are coming in, for also mid to long-term flexibility, not necessarily for batteries. But the huge needs of batteries are also represented into the numbers that we see at the moment in terms of grid connection requests, and also in terms of like the number of clients that we see are building batteries. At the moment, a lot of 2-hour batteries are being built. More and more 4 hours are coming the way. I would say that by 2030, we will have something between 10 to 20 gigs of batteries in Germany, something around that.
Wow. So a market that's 3 or 4 times the size of the UK right now.
Probably, but Germany is also very, very big. Huh? It's something that is also sometimes difficult to explain to internal stakeholders. I mean, Germany is a huge market, 300 gigawatts of renewables. It's a huge number. So like if you look at it compared to other countries, then you basically need to have like an approach that's relative to the scale of the renewable penetration effectively. So 20 gigs of BESS versus 300 gigs of, you know, renewables is actually quite normal.
And a peak load of 80 gigs. So
something like this,
roughly,
yeah.
Double the UK.
Yeah.
All right. And so you're a Frenchman, of course.
Yes.
Covering the German market. So how long have you been looking in the German world?
So I'm in Germany since 9 years. I came first at E.ON Markets, developing the flexibility business there. E.ON was quite advanced back in the days on that topic. Then moved to Vattenfall Trading, was heading up the biz dev team of trading like Key, and actually a few days ago was in this podcast. Exactly the same job. So there we built the Flex Desk, actually. That was my last part of my job there. So offering risk management solutions for customers of Vattenfall, and then moving now to ENGIE. So 9 years in Germany.
I'm
still liking it, actually.
Okay, can we talk about those targets for a second then? So these 2030, you mentioned there are targets, and whether we get there, I don't know, but they're pretty lofty. Can you just discuss what Germany's aiming for?
I mean, Germany is aiming for renewables plus flex, basically. That's the future of the country. That's something which is, I would say, kind of standard and understood now in the German landscape. The renewables target are in the law. That's also a difference. Nuclear is kind of gone, so there will be probably no coming back. And even if there would be a comeback, that would be very, very little in any case. The coal is in the process of being exited. So gas is still a bit there. There will be new gas power plants to take care of the mid to long-term flex topic that I was mentioning a bit before. So
as in like new CCGTs or?
Correct.
Yes. If you can get hold of turbines.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's not without any issues, clearly. It's also not without any issues with Brussels and with other countries that need to be okay with that, because the whole story is decarbonization. We should not forget that. So batteries are a nice piece of technology and equipment that are matching both the needs of the grids, of the markets, and are carbon-free to some extent.
And you talk about 300 gigs of renewables. That is a very difficult number to get your head around. You know, it's almost too big.
You can make what you want with those numbers. Will we end up at 200, 300, 250? It's a huge number. That's the point. And there's a huge commitment for the German society to actually get there. Not only from the people, from the politicians. We see that still today. I mean, with the new coalition, it's still, you know, pushing for more effectively. The consequences of that are more volatility in the market, more need to rebalance your portfolios, because it's not allowed in Germany to be imbalanced effectively. That is calling up for nice spreads on the intraday market, for instance, which is all the problems that batteries, short-term flexibility batteries, are coming there for, basically. So it's at the moment a good, I would say, very, very good ecosystem, which is very favorable for batteries, not only in the market, but also in terms of regulation.
Okay, let's talk about how batteries are actually operating in the market at the moment, because we're approaching a big change. The similar saturation problem that happened in GB and is happening in Texas right now is coming to Germany and pretty much any ancillary services-driven market, right? And then I think because of the huge investor appetite and the macro making sense for Germany, alongside that, there's also a lot of noise in the market. So we have a number of optimizers serving Germany. You've got utilities all fighting it out for what this future model looks like. You know, do asset owners want to be vertically integrated? Do they want to hand the keys to an optimizer? Do they want to get, you know, a toll with a utility? And I don't know, you might disagree with me, but it hasn't really become obvious what's going to happen in that market. In GB, it was very optimizer-led, but that hasn't become obvious, I don't think, in Germany. Although there are some incredible optimizers there by the looks of things, with, you know, large teams, great technology, and if they can do what they say they can do, could be incredibly disruptive. But on the back of that, of course, Central Europe and Western Europe is very utility-led in a way that we don't have in GB. So there's some big differences there. So that's me having a go at setting the scene. You will do much better. What's the state of play with route to market in Germany?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing to say is that, I mean, batteries, where do they make revenues? They make revenues on wholesale market, they had intraday, and on ancillary services. Maybe in the future on some other markets, capacity market, maybe all of that. But to make it super simple, it's ancillary services, day ahead and intraday.
And so just to be clear there, so there's no subsidies, no capacity market.
There's no need for subsidies in Germany, yeah. Which is great. I'm a firm believer in markets, to be honest. And I think that it's one of the good things in Germany. There's no need for subsidies whatsoever at the moment, at least for batteries. Full merchant assets get financed. Full toll assets also get financed still. So it is quite nice, actually. Those batteries are indeed making money. So on FCR, FRR mainly for primary and secondary reserve on ancillary services and on day-ahead intraday. In Germany, you have the biggest and more liquid by far market in Europe for day-ahead and intraday. You have a lot of needs to rebalance your portfolios because of the renewables that have to be balanced. So intraday liquidity is quite high. Intraday volatility is also quite high, which is the dream of any battery owner, effectively. I think what's something which is quite important to keep in mind at the moment, though, is that, I mean, ancillary services, as you say, are still quite high. Two-thirds of revenues of a two-hour battery in 2024. If you listen to some people, so two-thirds, depending on ancillary services, is quite a lot.
Two-thirds of the revenues from batteries.
It doesn't mean that, you know, all of that will be gone if ancillary services is saturated, because it's, you know, communicating vessels, of course. But still, you know, a 50% drop is absolutely not excluded in terms of ancillary services revenues only.
By the way, it was exactly the same in Great Britain in 2020, 21. It was like 80, 90% revenues came from FFR. And you know what? The market moved on.
Yeah, and it's not surprising. The good thing is that in Germany, you still have the day-ahead and intraday. liquidity is there, the volatility is also there and probably going to increase for a few years before batteries actually solve the topic. That's, you know, that's what markets are here for. Huh? It's mm-hmm. like giving the signals to then find the solutions to then solve the situation that was not super easy to solve without batteries. The good thing about Germany and the key difference, I would say, to JB, is how far you can trade. Basically, in Germany, you can trade up to Cal plus 9. Of course, it's not super liquid. So that means 9 years out, you can find a price in the market. Of course, liquidity is very little, but still that provides traders, people like us, with the ability to hedge long term. And when you can hedge long term, you can then take position long term, which is absolutely not the case everywhere. And of course, traders, when they take positions, they have very, very, very clear risk frameworks that they have to abide by, so to say. And if you don't have the hedging possibilities, then you cannot really take those positions. That's the first key difference. And I would say that at the moment, what's also calling for more tolls is just the tolling levels. You know, the tolling levels you can get in Germany are still 20 to 30% higher than in JB.
What do you mean by a level?
The price. So for the same, you know, battery, same capex, same, you know, approximately same cost, you can get a secured, completely secured or partially secured revenues, which is 20 to 30% higher than elsewhere. Which is where the big money guys come in. They're not the person that want to have the biggest, you know, revenues effectively, but have a safe or semi-safe invest. They are very, very happy. I mean, you can secure still double-digit IRRs without any risks, effectively, at least not market risks. That's why there's so much money being pulled down in Germany at the moment. And effectively, back to your question, what will be the winning scheme of revenues, nobody effectively knows. I think we will see more contracted because revenues will probably go down, as we've seen in any markets. The markets will solve their problem on their own, basically. That's the beauty of markets, right? So revenues will probably go down and this will be calling up for more hedging. We have seen that already. I mean, in 2023, 2022, don't need to speak about it with the corona years. In 2023, nobody wanted to hedge. You know, it was smaller projects, so fully merchant, fully equity, or balance sheet, sorry, financed effectively, so no need for hedging. In 2024, I still remember my mailbox after the Christmas 2024, we saw a lot of demand for floors, for hedges or partial hedges at least, because market dropped by 40%. The base load prices dropped quite significantly because, I mean, they are coming back a bit to normal after Corona, right? So, and after the Ukrainian war as well, sorry. So point being, like, people become more and more aware of the risk that they are getting into by seeing the prices of the market changes. When they get as well reports from, like, you know, all the big consultancy in Q1 versus the Q4 report that they got the year before, which is dropping by 20 or 30%, they also realize suddenly that market risk is a real topic and that hedging might be a good idea. So depending on where market prices are moving, effectively, we see more and more appetite for hedging or less appetite for hedging. So this will be a moving thing, I think. But the bigger assets that we see coming these days, I mean, 100 megawatts is probably the average size of an asset these days. What we talk to in terms of clients is probably 150 in terms of average size, to be honest. All those things are typically not fully balance sheet financed. So that's where the lenders come in. And lenders are very, very, very strict, effectively. You know, they don't want to take any risk or very, very little. So that's where the fixed price flexibility purchase agreements, as I call them, FPAs, are basically like matching their needs.
FPAs, which is... Excuse me, but similar to it's a PPA, but for flexibility.
Correct.
Okay. And the reason why that makes sense then is because if you can fund an asset with debt, then your cost of capital comes down and you're willing to accept lower revenues because your project's overall cheaper and you're happy to pass those on to a big balance sheet partner who can hedge it for you.
Absolutely. And you can still get nice revenues, nice returns. That's the good thing at the moment, at least, right? The toll levels will probably go down over years. That's clear. So at the moment, you can secure with no risk, like high level of tolls, which, you know, make you very happy, no risk and high return. So it's not necessarily like a compromise, effectively, that you do, right? So you can still get like very high returns, effectively, with no risk, which is exactly what some, like, you know, pension funds, for instance, would love to have. So they are striking a much higher return than they would expect, still with no risk, no market risk. So it's, I would not say it's a dream come true. It's probably a bit extreme, but kind of, effectively, for them. And that's what we see. Those are the clients we also talk to, not only asset developers, but also all these investors that have like a lot of capital to put on the table, or like lending banks that want to really lend a lot of money and then are happy to see people like us then providing them risk management solutions.
So say I come to you, NG, and I've got a couple of 100 megawatt site and I want to do a tolling agreement with you, or I want to pass that risk on to you, that market risk. What duration of a contract are you open to at NG? What does that look like? And then my second part of this question is, there is a limit to how much of this risk NG could take on its balance sheet, right? So how many 100 megawatts or gigawatts could you guys handle of this flexibility?
It all depends how you risk manage them. And that's the big difference, I would say, from NG compared to other players. NG has the ability to risk manage their positions. We don't only sit on risks like some utilities, unfortunately, still do these days. And that means that conceptually speaking, there is no limit to what we can swallow as long as we can really manage those risks, right? We could build a huge portfolio. That's also how utilities in the past have built like huge portfolios of conventional assets and huge portfolios of clients. It's just because they hedge effectively. That's the only possibility not to die. We've seen that in corona times once more, like utilities, especially in the UK, not hedging. It can end up pretty, pretty bad. So batteries, to your point, for us, we don't have necessarily, at least for Germany, I can speak for Germany, we don't have necessarily a limit. We think that we will need between 2 to 3 gigawatts for our portfolios of renewables and downstream clients by 2030. It's a broad range, plus, minus, not necessarily super precise. And we think we can get there, not only because we are quite good, I would say, at structuring and origination or trading as well, algo trading, which we have in-house, but also because we can risk manage. Because at some point, adding batteries to batteries to batteries, it's adding the same risk all the way. And that cannot work. It's similar to renewables. You need to hedge your positions. Otherwise, building like a long position in renewables or a long flex position at some point can really kick back effectively.
So say I'm going to build this asset, right? And it's a 20-year asset, 20-year design life or 25-year design life. How much of that would I wrap up with you guys in an agreement?
Yeah, it all depends when the battery starts. If the battery was to start today, I would say we could do up to 10 years. That's not necessarily a problem for us, to be honest, because we have the portfolio behind that supports those needs, effectively. We can also do 3 to 5 years contract. That's really not a problem. And it all depends when the asset starts, I would say. The later the asset starts, the less years we can do, obviously, because at some point it comes to years which we don't, you know, we have really no view on, or no position or no liquidity in the market to hedge. So that's basically the defining factors of like how many years we would do effectively.
And I guess the decision that asset owners have got to make is, the optimizers would argue, because they don't have the balance sheet that NG has, but they would argue that their merchant capture would be higher because they have better technology. That's the pitch for an optimizer, right?
That's the pitch because they have to be honest. Huh? I mean, we have very good optimizers. I don't necessarily want to say negative things because we are lucky in Germany. We have very capable optimizers. We work with these optimizers, help them on some contracts as well.
How do you work with an optimizer? Don't you come up against each other?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's not only the balance sheet that differentiates ourselves. It's the risk management tools, capabilities and know-how. Basically, those things they don't have. Optimizers are good at optimizing. They are not good and they cannot take risks because they cannot manage them and they cannot onboard them because of their balance sheet. It's not only a balance sheet thing to manage risk. It's also like a risk management capabilities. It's tooling and people. And that is much, much, much harder effectively than just optimizing in a way. At the end of the day, you know, comparing performances from optimizers to utilities, we have been doing quite a lot of backtests here in my job and in my previous jobs as well. I hate to say it, but it's not rocket science to optimize a battery at the end of the day, right? That's the real truth. And everybody will come to the approximate same results.
That's your first contrarian view.
Probably, yes. But that's actually the truth. I mean, there is one thing that you need to keep in mind is that, of course, as an optimizer, if you're not convincing enough that you can get the best revenues whatsoever in the market or that your margin is also the lowest, then you don't get any clients, right? So you need to be convincing, sometimes pretending for some, not for all. That's a good thing, effectively, that you have the best revenues and that you can bring the best margins to the clients. Effectively, if you were to come to someone like us, which are also, I mean, optimizing assets, we have an algo desk, actually quite advanced in some years, we can bring the same revenues and probably even more. The reason behind is that we take risks. That means that if I cannot do at least what the optimizers are doing, I might be bleeding money on my tollings, effectively, on my FPAs, right? So that's the reason why we are equally good is not only because it's, you know, something that we do since years, but it's also because we effectively take risk. And the only way, I mean, one of the best ways to get better at something is effectively to have a risk somewhere. If you have a, if you have like 100 megawatts of a fixed price agreement with someone in your portfolio, then you better be good at optimizing it behind, because otherwise you really, really make a loss. A loss, not only like less revenues, but a loss, like a really proper red number in your P&L. So that's, I think, a key difference with the optimizers. Huh? It's not only balance sheet, it's also risk management capabilities around them. So when we work with them, it's to support them, like offering maybe sometimes floors, which they cannot because they don't have the balance sheets, and nor the structuring capabilities to do a floor effectively. So we bring them like sometimes financial products that they can combine with their optimization. And I think, to be honest, there is a future for those, for those products, because I mean, optimizers are far better than utilities when it comes to transparency, when it comes to be flexible with the clients, when it comes to having conversations sometimes with the clients in a much more frequent manner than what we would do. We are not necessarily the best at this. Let's be very honest, right? Risk management, they, however, cannot do. So combining basically the two capabilities, one on the transparency side, the other one on risk management side, is maybe a good future-proof solution for some clients, at least.
Let's change lanes for a second and talk about the two big risks in most markets around the world, which is cannibalization risk. So there needs to be build out of renewables and solar to match the batteries in some sort of exchange rate, not one for one. But if you look at what's happening in Australia, for example, solar build out has pretty much stalled because there was over build out. And so if there's too much batteries built in Australia without the addition of some more solar, there is a number out there, it's in the double digits, but there's a number out there of gigawatts where you where batteries start to cannibalize each other, although they also cannibalize, you know, peaking plant and other things as well along the way. So if we let's talk about cannibalization first. How do you think about that in Germany? And then I'm going to ask you about saturation. So cannibalization, what's the risk? This, set the scene, it's the year 2028.
Mm-hmm. I'd say in 2028, we are still good, to be honest. That's my personal view that I'm sharing here. I would say cannibalization might happen, especially, I mean, you know, on some markets like intraday that are still, you know, liquid and deep in Germany. But at some point, if you start to have like a lot of batteries in there that are fighting effectively, like for the same prices, especially intraday was the liquidity is lower than day ahead, of course, then those, especially those extreme prices that we see often on LinkedIn effectively, they will disappear.
LinkedIn prices.
No, those are real prices, by the way.
Yeah.
Still, like those very extreme prices, which are a huge portion of the revenues of the batteries, especially intraday revenues, that's where cannibalization will start to appear. I think cannibalization of batteries will not be as bad as saturation, which we will discuss in a minute maybe. And it will not be as bad as cannibalization of solar, for instance, because solar is really like one defined pattern, which is, you know, defined by the sun, and there's nothing you can do about it. So that's where cannibalization really kicks in. For batteries, you can still steer the asset. That's an asset that makes money based on how much you steer it effectively. So you're still a bit less exposed to cannibalization, I would say.
So when does cannibalization start to be a problem then?
I think when we have a lot of batteries and when the intraday prices that are like super high are being like, you know, cannibalized by batteries. So if your neighbor has a battery, if they have a battery, if you want to get like those extreme 5,000 euro per megawatt hour price, maybe they get it before you do. And then you cannot catch these prices anymore. And then effectively, that's where your revenues, especially intraday, might go a bit down. I think the real cannibalization or saturation for me is really coming from the ancillary services, to be honest. It's obvious that the markets will go down on that one. FCR is a very, very small market. So primary reserve, 600 megawatts, it's basically nothing compared to day ahead and intraday. And then AFRR, I mean, I still believe that in the future you will be able to make money on AFRR energy, but all the products that are more capacity driven, so FCR and AFRR capacity, they have a history, first of all, of saturation. I mean, anyone that has been doing flex like we did in the years 2018 in Germany remembers what happened then, effectively. And this might be, again, coming up, basically. So energy-driven products like AFRR energy, intraday day-ahead, I think will be the future, to be honest, which is also something that is important when you design your battery. So 1 hour batteries, I think, are anyway in the past that everybody understood. But even 2 hours batteries might be becoming a bit more and more challenged effectively by this transition.
All right, I'm going to pull you up on something you talked about earlier, which is a FPA, all right?
Yeah.
Which I think is a power purchase agreement with a different name, but you can tell me I'm wrong. Okay, let's do that. What's an FPA? Why is it different to a PPA? And why introduce this new acronym?
Because what you buy is flexibility. You don't buy power. You don't buy renewable production, you buy flexibility. You're buying the ability to get access to a flexible capacity. And effectively, the underlying product is not power or not only power, it's a spread, basically. So I think that this word FPA is actually quite good because it really insists on what you're buying. Some people buy or like do tolls without really knowing what they buy these days. That's unfortunately the case. So, you know, you have clients and we see competitors also coming up with term sheets that are PPAs, you know, term sheets. When you bring that to a battery, it doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. A PPA is something where you buy power and renewables certificates, of course, with some clauses. It's still complex, non-standard most of the time, term sheets and long forms. FPAs are even more complex because you have all the optimization rules and all the physical aspects of the batteries that need to be properly represented into the term sheet and into the contract at some point. So that's why FPAs are for me like a term that's, you know, might work. In the end, PPAs were there for power purchase agreement. FPAs are just there for flexibility purchase agreement.
So let's say you sign a couple of hundred megawatts with a battery, the one I mentioned earlier in Germany. What does that agreement look like? What's in there? What tools do you have legally or contractually to wrap this thing up and make sure that risk is represented and then transferred?
Yeah. So, and that's the job of a structurer, basically. Originators and structurers are paid to effectively represent all those risks. So it could be market risk, of course. That's the key and the king of all risks, effectively. Then you have all the regulatory risks that need to be represented. So when the tax system is changing, when the regulation for grid fees is changing potentially one day, you have all the technical parameter risk, all the warranty terms that need to be represented properly into the term sheet and into the contract. So what can you do with the batteries? How much resting time do you have to do between two cycles? What's the upper limit? What's the under limit? What are the round trip efficiencies? What are the degradation curve? And how do you measure that effectively over time? Because when you offer a fixed price, the fixed price is typically priced on some assumptions. So if the assumptions become true on year one, but not true anymore on year two or year five, then of course you have paid for something as a trader that is not there. So you need to settle the difference. At the same time, it can also be a bonus, to be honest, right? Some clients will perform better than planned. Round trip efficiency might be higher, degradation might be lower than planned, which is great. And then that also needs to be represented because the clients have been doing a better job at the end. So they need to be retributed.
Both of those things are quite normal and quite common, right? Because for a quality project, what you have written in your supply of the equipment and the warranty, usually there's margins of safety in there from the commercial negotiations. Both sides, there's bits of safety on top, and then when you run the asset, often it does a bit better than it says on paper, right?
Correct, but you still don't want to pay the damages, and especially if you have a bank behind or if you have a trader that is offering you a toll. You would always prefer, at least that's what I see in the market currently, to be on the conservative side to avoid paying damages. You would much rather see like a realistic picture being sold to someone instead of like selling them dreams. So to say that will end up being penalties.
And that, so there's a margin of safety on your side in the contracting as well, right? So you're doing it on both sides here.
But we give that back to the clients. Let's be clear. Not everybody does. I find it fair to give that back to the clients. Basically, when you do an FPA, a fixed price FPA at least, we are taking the market risk for you against your performance on the technical side. So if you perform better than planned on the technical side, you should be retributed for this. If I'm performing better than the tolls, that's also, you know, that's also where I'm retributed. So I think it's a good and fair.
So things like if my availability is higher or my usable capacity is higher in the period or whatever, then we can share some more of that upside.
Correct. I find it fair.
Yeah, sounds fair to me.
But all those contracts, just to be clear, are also non-standard. That's something we are really in a world of non-standard contracts, so it's difficult to say that it should be the norm. All the clients have different risk appetites. So some clients will not say, look, I don't want to have this bonus, but I want to have something else instead. And that's all the balance of the agreements that you need to be finding one to the other, effectively. And that's why standardization of those contracts, I think, is a bit of a myth, to be honest. A good portion can be standardized for sure, but not everything. We've seen this standardization dream for PPAs since, I think, 10 years,
In wind, and you've still got this.
It's still not there.
Still pay a fortune to lawyers because it's complicated stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let me ask you about a word that I've heard you mention before. So, bubble. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
The question is, are we in a bubble or not? I don't have.
You have to interview yourself now, and I just throw a word out. That's how this podcast works now.
Yeah, perfect.
I've given up.
No, perfect. So, bubble, yes or no? I think that's the key question. I mean, when you look at 500 gigawatts of grid connection requests, one could say, yes, it's a huge bubble, of course. At the same time, those numbers are to be taken with a huge pinch of salt.
There's not much skin in the game for many of those gigawatts in Germany, right?
Exactly that. So it's a lot of ghost projects. In the past, it wasn't taking so much money to develop projects, effectively, almost none. Now the rules are going to change a bit, like we've seen in the UK before. So it's not necessarily a big surprise. Germany is just following up, basically, like all the mature markets. We are not yet in a bubble. I don't think so. But the question is, like in 27, 28, when we start to have like a few gigawatts of battery, real numbers of gigawatts on the batteries, what happens to the revenues of ancillary services? What happens to the revenues of intraday, especially the continuous intraday market, which is where we make most money at the moment currently with a battery? And that might be then the moment where we might be talking more about a bubble and decreasing revenues. I don't think that we are yet in the bubble. I mean, the revenues that we still make on batteries are huge, and it's because there's not enough batteries. But the question is, like, when there will be a lot of batteries, if all the pipeline that all the developers are materializing, I mean, if you don't have a gigawatt in your pipeline, you're not a good developer these days, then we will see if we were or not in the bubble. I think future will tell, to be honest.
You'd think that there were lessons learned from other markets, right? And I don't know. That's literally me saying this time it's different, which I know is a bit stupid.
No, it's actually very fair what you say, because we see, I mean, we have a lot of clients, right? We have a lot of clients on the asset development side and investment side. What we definitely observe is a difference between the German only, so to say, clients and the one that are coming from the UK. The one that are coming from the UK have made their experiences,
That's cynical.
And they are much more, in terms of risk management, not necessarily on the rest, but on the risk management side, they are aware, right? Yeah. It doesn't mean that they will fully hedge, but at least they are aware of this risk. They are aware that it needs to be looked at. And then they can take a conscious, non-biased decision whether or not to hedge, or to hedge partially, maybe to hedge a few assets or at portfolio levels. But at least they know. And we see that very, very clearly in the conversations that they have, right? That we have, sorry, with them. So that's, I think, lessons learned have been taken, I think, for some. I think the people that probably will suffer the most, if I'm right, saying that the revenues will go down, are the ones that have started in Germany and that have not necessarily been looking at risk management topics.
All right, so I know that one of the things that's close to your heart is this word bankable, mm-hmm. right? We talked about it over a beer last night. And so what's your thesis on battery assets and whether they are bankable now, or whether what they need to do, or the market needs to do to make them bankable assets? And I know you come from a risk management perspective.
Yeah. No, I mean, at the end of the day, risk management is something which is very tailor-made to the profile of investors. So a bankable asset might be a different definition if you ask like a lending bank, or if you ask like a pure equity investor, or if you ask a utility or an asset developer, basically. So I think there's all shades of grays in terms of what bankability means. Where I struggle a bit with the term bankable, it's that for me, something which is bankable should be something which is robust. At least that's what we've seen in renewables space, so to say, and in the past as well with conventional assets, effectively. So bankable would, for me, in my definition, mean something you can really rely on, something which is there and will stay the same. So that means at least a portion of fixed price. Anything which is not a fixed price and just a forecast, effectively, is worth a forecast, effectively. We know that forecasters are having a tough job, to be honest. It's almost an impossible job. So it's a bit easy to be tough on them. But at the same time, I think you need to realize that a forecast is changing, basically, right? Every quarter, you get your new curve from all the typical consultants. And then you will realize each every quarter whether or not the curve was really bankable. That's a bit the definition that's where I struggle on the word bankability.
Well, I would challenge that. So I guess the first thing to say is that I am naturally biased because we do forecasting and are launching our German forecast very soon. And it's been, and as with all markets that we enter, for us as Modo, we come up against, you know, the incumbents, right? Who we have to work 10 times harder than the incumbents because we are naturally a much smaller company. And so for us to become bankable in Europe and in the UK and be approved for debt raises and hundreds of millions of assets in asset capex and whatnot, that's taken us probably about 3 years to get there. And that process, what we would define bankability, would be hundreds of hours with credit committees in banks and transparency and talking through our fundamentals model. So I think that is a real thing, because you really have to get approved and get assets financed using your curves. Having done it and having gone through it is one hell of a process. And so I take my hat off to the companies that went before us as well to do that too. But what I would challenge about what you're saying is, for the job of a forecaster, what is our job as a forecaster? Our job is to build a picture of the future with some judgment from our view of the market, in an intellectually honest way, and in our view at Modo, to do it in a transparent and demonstrate governance in the way that we produce and release these forecasts. So if we can do all those things, we're happy. However, when you're building a fundamentals model, which is essentially it's a long time horizon, 20, 30 years, then I don't think you can. I'm aware that this sounds like forecaster excuse, right? But if you can look past that, I don't think you can judge a fundamentals model on, which is trying to predict a couple of things. It's trying to predict power prices and also volatility in a kind of 20, 30 year horizon. I don't think you can judge that on a quarterly basis for now, because if you were trying to see what happened next quarter, you would take a different modeling approach to a fundamentals model.
Yeah, probably. So I think for me, the key word is actually in what you say is bias, effectively. I think there's good and bad in consulting, right? And as said, I think their job is impossible in terms of forecasting, right? They are for sure selling something wrong, and they know that, their clients know that, everybody knows that, but that's normal. They cannot be right. Of course, for 20 to 30 years, it's impossible, right? I think the challenge that we observe with these fundamental providers is that they are not, for some, not all, looking enough at the market. So what's the real truth that is said by the market, which is the best picture that you have today in terms of revenues, right? If you look at that, then you end up with different forecasts, effectively, and you should be in a position to update your view, change it according to what the real truth is. The difficulty is that if you start with a forecast which is like based on a view, which is yours and or like the one of someone else, and you come to trading or to people like this that really have skin in the game and suddenly want to take a position in the market, they will not be able to tell you, look, that's my belief in the future. That is basically, you know, what I see in the market. So the fair value of a battery is often different than the fundamental view of the battery.
All right, I want to give plenty of time for your contrarian view. So tell me, is there anything you want to plug from NG or you and your team?
What I'm quite proud of is the team that we have, effectively, and the fact that we were like front runners in signing the first tolling agreement in Germany and in continental Europe last year, effectively, for more than 100 megawatts of battery for 7 years, which we are super
Congrats.
Proud of. Thank you. It shows how much the commitment of NG is, effectively, to make this piece of like a battery and short-term flexibility advance to benefit for the energy transition. It's really what drives us at the end. I think globally speaking, we are super happy to talk to any client that are in need of risk management capabilities, be it a toll, a partial toll, you know, like swaps that we also offer. We are also very innovative and, you know, each and every month thinking of new ideas on how to match the client's need versus what we can offer. And we have the freedom to design what we want in terms of product and this non-standard origination business, effectively, that we do. So yeah, we have a huge appetite as well. If your clients have needs, we're happy to accommodate.
Okay, well, if you're listening to this and you want to get in touch with Martin, we're going to put some links to the team at NG and to you personally in the show notes. All right, now let's do your contrarian views. Mm-hmm. So what do you believe that not a lot of other people believe?
I think what I personally believe is that there's a lot of bias of information in the market at the moment for various players. One of them could be optimizers that basically need to paint a nice story for the future. The other one might be consulting firms or forecast providers. I think there's lots of what do you want to see or what do you want to hear, and I will paint it for you at the moment a bit in the market. We've seen that as well in the past. And that's something which I think needs to be solved. So maybe by people like you that would, you know, dare to say sometimes the painful truth to the clients or the painful risks that are coming potentially their way. I think that's something that not a lot of people believe into. At least, you know, we are often accused as traders who say to steal money from clients. I would completely disagree with that. I think we have a view on the market, which is the fair value of what the market themselves thinks, based on the future prices, based on also on our curves, to be honest. And we are willing to put money on the table, skin in the game, based on our beliefs. And that's where it stops. So the price that we typically give, and that's maybe the second contrary view, is a fair price. That's the price that includes taking away all the risks. So traders are not people that steal anyone. Effectively, they are the ones that take risks away. And either the risks are managed and then, yes, of course, it's priced in, or you as an owner carry the risk fully. And then the risk might be coming your way. The worst part being that you probably don't have any means to manage that. Huh? We have seen that in the UK with some investors that suffered maybe not losses, but like huge disappointments, and that had then to turn to traders to hedge, which is probably the worst moment in time to hedge effectively. You would rather want to hedge when prices are high, which is maybe, I can understand that. It might be counterintuitive for some investment committees, but you definitely don't want to come to traders when the market has gone down. That's the worst moment ever to lock prices effectively.
I'm going to use this opportunity to do a bit of a plug for Modo, actually, which is that one of the things I talk to the team about a lot, and it's in our DNA, is that one of the businesses we really aspire to and respect is S&P. And one of the things we say a lot within the company is that we want to be trusted even when the answers aren't easy. And so if the market's down 20%, if the NASDAQ's down 20% or the S&P's 500's down, better example, 20%, then you know you can, S&P will tell you it's down 20%. It is the ground truth. And I agree with you. I think that it's just part of the cycle of these investment cycles that there is some bias introduced. I don't think anyone's a bad actor in this. It's just part of a load of cash going somewhere into a market and a great deal of opinion. And what we specialize in is, on top of doing the fundamentals modeling, which is it's an economical view of the future, there's a lot of judgment that we think is value add that we put on top. And then that judgment is seeded in how assets are really making money, which is why we spend so much time doing benchmarking. That, in our view, that's something that we can stand behind and we think is an intellectually honest way to approach these problems. But yeah, there are moral hazards, of course, with someone who takes market positions also being the advisor to the market. And you don't have to be a genius to figure that one out, even though I don't think there's nothing underhand happening here. It is just a part of life. So what do you think happens next then?
Now we will see what happens next. I think we will see more and more batteries coming up in Germany. What people also sometimes need to take into account in Germany is that, I mean, to make money, a battery doesn't only need spreads. That's often what I hear, right? That's maybe the last controversial view that I have. It's like, you know, there will always be volatility. Maybe, maybe not, by the way. But to make money, basically, batteries need a few things. They need volatility, but volatility around a certain price level, right? So if prices go down at equal volatility, you make less money. The shape of the price is extremely important. Everybody knows about this duck curve, right? So if the duck curve flattens and becomes, I don't know which animal, then in the future, we'll see. Yeah, maybe. Then, I mean, the day ahead part, effectively, of the batteries will suffer huge times. Ancillary services, of course, we've talked a lot about it. That's clear. That's a huge component. And the missing child, which is often forgotten in all the discussions, for good or bad reasons, I don't know, is liquidity. Liquidity is the ability to find buyers and sellers in front of your position. So if you desire to sell or buy as an algo trader, basically, if you find no one in front of you, then you might not be able to close your position or not at the price that you wanted. And that is, of course, where saturation or cannibalization of intraday prices might come in. And this is something which is to be monitored, because effectively, batteries being super, super fast, they can catch, or the algos behind them can catch good prices, but up to the amount of liquidity which is into the market. So yes. If liquidity goes down, effectively, then prices or revenue, so to say, of intraday and maybe other markets will go down. So that's maybe the last controversial view. Batteries do not only need volatility to make money. Absolutely not. All those other factors, which are all surrounded and impacted by market risk, so things moving in the market, are important factors, effectively.
But I guess the reason why, if I'm going to counter that, the reason why, and this isn't my position, just trying to think, you know, play steel man this argument. I think the reason why volatility is mentioned so much is because, so the other element that you're talking about, so liquidity and a base load price to have spreads around, are sort of baked into the market. If you have I think that's assumed that those things are going to be there. So tell me the other way, right? So what's the future where liquidity dries up in the intraday market in Germany, for example?
It could be very simple. If the scaling of batteries goes super, super fast, then you will have a lot of people competing for the same price for a very small product. After all, like, you know, the intraday continuous market is made of 96 quarter of an hours, which are not a huge products like the day ahead, which are like more, you know, huge volumes coming into the market at the same time on production and consumption side. So for those smaller products, I would say that the liquidity will be smaller. That's it. So the ability to really close your position when you see a good price is going to be much more complex going forward. And if you combine this effectively to ancillary services going down or saturating, let's see where it all ends up, plus then intraday being more challenging, I would say, not necessarily impossible, but more challenging, then that leads you to being very good at day ahead, effectively. And that's where the utilities will be, that's also my view, much, much, much better than others, because that's what they do since decades. So knowing the market and like how to really bid into this market is today not necessarily like a must have, I would say, to make money on batteries. As long as you can do a decent forecast on ancillary services and a decent algo speed of trade and execution into intraday, whilst of course respecting the technical parameters of the batteries, which is super important to be able to be back to back versus your market positions, then you will be good. But in the future, wholesale market will take a bigger role, and especially the day ahead part. That's at least what I think.
All right, Martin, we could have gone on much, much longer. I want to say a huge thank you for coming and joining us in London. It's been a pleasure to have you, and of course to see you at the cricket last night. And next time we'll have you on, we'll just do all contrarian views.
Perfect. Sounds like a great plan. Thanks so much for the invitation for cricket last night as well. That was great. And looking forward to the next one.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.